I am Plata on the line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Joe Calandino grew up in East Vancouver. He was actually born in Prince Rupert and had spent some early years in the Okanagan, but it was the time here that shaped him. He was what they call nowadays a student at risk. There were some teachers and school counselors who tried reaching out to try and tame the street fighter. Young Joe's goal is to join the Hells Angels. He wants the camaraderie, the glamour of gang life. Soon he spirals into drug addiction. He recounts his life thus far, the struggle with substance abuse and recovery, and his work now launching the Yo Bro Yo Girl initiative that empowers youth against involvement in drugs, violence, and gangs. Joe Calandino joins me now, as does Gary Little, an educator and Joe's former high school counselor. Their new book is To Hell and Back, and it's published by LNC Press. I spoke to Joe and Gary last week. Gary, incidentally, was the principal of Sir Charles Tupper Secondary for a few years when I was there. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Joe Calandino and Gary Little. Mr. Calandino, good morning.
Good morning.
And Mr. Little, good morning.
Good morning.
So, when did you guys first meet?
We first met in 1984, and it was when I was humbly asked to leave one school and enter another school, and that's where Gary Little and I first encountered each other.
And in what school was this, Gary?
It was a Templeton school,
yeah.
And Joe had moved, if I've got my facts correct, working from memory, six or seven schools before Templeton. So we really weren't sure that Joe was going to make it through to graduation, but lo and behold, he did, and it was something we were all as a staff quite proud of, frankly.
And Joe, you did the tour of the V side, didn't you? I mean, I remember reading the book, and there's a list there of all the places that you went to Tupper, where I went, and Gary was principal at one point.
Yeah, that's correct. I visited several schools, and not for very long periods of time. I was actually very fortunate to have my path cross Gary Little's because I think Gary had a bit of a soft spot for the guys that, well, traditionally back then you wouldn't call them at risk. They were the more tougher guys that liked to rumble in the jungle. And, you know, today there's a word that we identify particular youth that identified with the same behaviors as I did, and that was youth at risk. And I think Gary was pretty adamant to, A, keeping us in the school, B, making sure that, you know, we continued with our education, and C, always gave us a stern talking to pre-Friday nights.
I'm not sure it did a lot of good, but I gave him the stern talking to. One of the things, Joseph, that was really important for me as an educator was a comment made by a coach at the University of Notre Dame, which I attended back in the late 1960s and early 1970s. The coach was a gentleman named Digger Phelps, who was a basketball coach. And he said, if you want to connect with kids, you have to learn to cross the street. In other words, you can't wait for them to come to you. You have to cross the street to them. And when you talk about crossing the street, the metaphor is important because those are the marginalized kids. Those are the kids who aren't really connecting to the classroom. And Joe was, I would say, I would lump him in with those that group at Templeton. Good kids, love those guys, but they were the across the street group.
So, Joe, what was it? I mean, you write in the book about your family.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very loving family, your mom, your dad, your brother and your sister.
Mm-hmm.
But you wanted something more.
Yeah, I think I always had a bit of an attraction to, you know, the bad boy, identifying with a certain lifestyle, being that guy. One of my goals that I set forth at a very young age is by the time I hit grade 12, I want to be the toughest guy in the high school.
You wanted to be a street fighter. You wanted to be the guy that no one messed with.
I loved street fighting. I wanted to be the guy that nobody messed with, but I didn't really have the size that went with that kind of demeanor. So, you know, I always had to prove myself. I was, you know, 5'8", 5'9", 155 pounds, and when I fought to win,
and
I usually did.
And you write in the book about the brotherhood, the camaraderie that you sought in some of these guys.
Yeah, Gary captured that in the book very, very well in his writings. And, you know, that's one of the things that people always think that you're identifying with that particular lifestyle, is the brotherhood. I've got your back, you know, that bond, that sense of belonging to something bigger than yourself. But, you know, when you're in that lifestyle, it's most people will worry about themselves, not worry about you. You know, in the moment, yeah, you may fight as a crew, but when the cops kick open that door and, you know, now you got to face the music, usually a lot of people won't be there to face the music with you or do that dance.
What do you, Gary, as you're talking to Joe about his life and you're writing this and, mm-hmm. and the appeal of that lifestyle, the appeal of an organization like the Hells Angels on young people, does that surprise you that gang life is still as palatable for people, or that they this is something that they want? I mean, we're in the midst of a crisis here in this part of the world. That young people are still drawn to that, no matter how many films they've seen or the consequences that they know will happen.
You know, it's interesting to me that I think everybody wants a sense of belonging to something that's important to them. And one of the gentlemen I worked with when I was at the Vancouver School Board was a gentleman, superintendent of schools named Chris Kelly. And he used to talk about autonomy, belonging, and competence. And that everybody strives to belong. Everybody wants to feel they have a degree of autonomy. But people want to feel competent in their lives. And I think for Joe, as with many, many young people, they look for those areas that really draw them in terms of they're being able to show their competence, and Joel was a fighter, as he said, mm-hmm. To be able to belong to something that's important to them. And one of the interesting parts of the book, from my point of view, is when asked why he wants to become a Hells Angels member, Joel said, I want to be part of the brotherhood. I want to be part of something that really is like a person who's part of a team. And why do we join teams? Not just because we love playing hockey or we love playing soccer, we love dancing or whatever the team happens to be. It's important for us to feel we belong to something greater than ourselves. And I think as long as people are alive, we're going to have that phenomenon at play. And that, unfortunately, for some young people, leads to gang involvement. So the critical question, and the work Joe does now, is how do we work with young people to give them alternatives, positive alternatives to that?
No, I went to Tupper, where you were principal at one point. Did you see kids like that who were at risk, who thought that this was a glamorous lifestyle that they ought to get into?
Well, absolutely.
And so what do you do to steer them away?
Well, I'll give you an example from your time at Tupper, Joseph. It's really simple. We had a group of kids who were breakdancing in the hallway. They used to go down to the first floor. And I had pressure from some members of staff. They shouldn't be doing that in the hallway at lunchtime. One of the reasons I felt it was important to give those kids that space was because if they're there, they're pretty positively connected to one another, to the school, and to their music. Whereas if we had flushed them outside, who knows where that would have taken those kids. So, I mean, it's a small example, but I think it's an important one. Again, it's that metaphor of crossing the street, of reaching out to engage the kids rather than have them come to us. And if we open up opportunities, I've always been absolutely amazed by how many amazing positive things kids will do and surprise a lot of adults.
You grew up in the 80s, Joe.
Mm-hmm.
What sort of childhood was it like for you? I mean, I mentioned your mom, your dad, your siblings. I mean, it was a pretty close family.
It was a very close family.
Yeah, and so growing up in the neighborhood that you grew up in, and I guess did that precipitate the sort of lifestyle that you eventually you found yourself in?
I wouldn't. My family was, you know, never ever wanted me to embark in those journeys or come home after a weekend or, you know, always be fighting. That's not something my father or my mother wanted me to do, but I made that choice, right? So at the end of the day, my parents were had an open door policy, and everybody was welcome at our home. All the neighborhood kids would come over to Mr. and Mrs. C's house, and, you know, as Gary put in the book, And we were the neighborhood house, so.
It was like the 7-Eleven, never closed, right?
Yeah, exactly. If the kids needed somewhere, you know, they were scared to go home or for whatever reason, they knew they could knock on our door, and the door was always open. If kids were hungry, there was always pasta brewing and, you know, the smell of wine and sausage downstairs. And it was just a very, you know, traditional Italian home.
So it's one thing to want to fight people all the time and get into brawls. When does the desire to kill someone, when does that come into your life?
Well, I've never had that desire. So.
But it's always, when you hang out with certain people, I guess they always want you to think that or they want you to do that. How do you fight that then?
Well, at the end of the day, your integrity and your core values have to be intact, and you have to know your line in the sand, right? And you have to be able to express or be able to say no, that this is not something I'm willing to do or cross that line, right? And yes, I know that you'd probably, you know, like to hear something different, but that's never a line that I wanted to cross, right?
Yeah, there was a moment where you're at a club with someone.
Mm-hmm.
And he
I had a loaded 45. Correct?
Yeah, and your friend wanted you to kill somebody.
No, nobody wanted me to kill anybody.
Yeah.
It was my choice to put that gun in my waistband that evening.
Yeah,
right?
Well, I'm thinking of a different event where you actually knew the guy that your friend wanted you.
The incident when you went outside,
yeah,
with an individual. And your partner inside was drunk, he was angry,
yeah,
he was screaming, shoot him, Joe, shoot him.
And oh,
you,
yeah,
made the choice to go outside and
then,
say to this person you knew, listen, you get out of here.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. He got away, you told,
yeah,
your friend later.
I asked
later.
Him,
yeah,
to leave. Exactly.
There are moments, I've just started the book, I haven't finished it yet, but there are moments like that where there are people that you encounter growing up, as you're an adult, and then they come back into your life,
mm-hmm,
in a significant way. And,
mm-hmm,
and that was one of the first moments as I'm reading the book,
mm-hmm,
where there was someone from your childhood,
mm-hmm,
and that sort of, that was the line. You knew where the line was, and you weren't going to cross it.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
Do you think about fate at all and things like that? I mean, do you buy into that sort of stuff?
Well, absolutely. You know, this journey of to hell and back was never Joe's journey. This was always bigger than Joe. I had to go through what I went through in order to get where I was going. You know, you can't whiteboard everything that's happened in my life and then have all the stars perfectly aligned with all the people coming back into my life to make sure Joe's able to do the work that he does. Right? You can't script this. You know, old classmate becomes biker gang task force policeman, is the one to put his hand in. Then we go back to our old high school with one of our old teachers. And before I can make the move into other schools, I have to stand in front of, now at the time, the associate superintendent of schools in the Vancouver School District, being my ex-high school counselor. So you can't script that. I don't care who you are. At the end of the day, this was, you know, something that, call it, you know, God, your higher power, something bigger than all of us, was the puppet master in all this. You know, this is something bigger than I could even envision. You know, today I was interviewed this morning on another network, and, you know, what's the likelihood, like you talking to Gary and being from Tupper, right? But
yeah,
your paths never crossed.
Yeah.
This morning we had a lady interview us that was from Prince Rupert. So how do you script that in one day?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
two interviews, you knew Gary, she knew the story from Prince Rupert. Like,
yeah,
really?
Yeah.
Come on.
I mean, Gary, someone who's helped put this book together, it's a hell of a narrative, isn't it?
Well, you know, it's there are two things come to mind, Joseph. Number one, I always remember one of my favorite authors in the 19th century era, Thomas Hardy, was accused of too many coincidences in his writing. And it was tough to suspend disbelief when you've got these crazy coincidences, right? And people who have read the book read it and think, you know, this truth almost reads like fiction. It's hard to believe all these coincidences have happened in Joe's life, and frankly, in my own life. And yet, here we are. And, you know, you've got the coincidence of Joe with Kevin Torvik, the ex-classmate, now cop, who reaches out and helps him. You've got a coincidence of myself and Joe reconnecting years after he graduated from high school. And I knew what Joe had been up to through some of the presentations of the Vancouver police. And I knew that he'd been involved in the Hells Angels. Frankly, I never expected to see Joe again. So, Amy comes into my office at the school board. I could go on. But you've got all these coincidences that almost read like fiction. And there's an old saying in writing, if the truth reads like fiction, make fiction read more like the truth. So tone it down. Yeah. I haven't toned it down in this book. Yeah. What you read are the coincidences that are part of Joe's life. And they're amazing, I think.
Yeah, and one of the most, you know, at the end of the day, I come out of the lifestyle and, you know, I'm doing my courses. And this girl walks up to me as I'm doing these courses at BCIT. And she says, you got to meet my mom. And I'm thinking, my God, if she looks anything like you, I really like to meet her. And she is the high incident coordinator for school district and has been working with vulnerable families for 25 years. Well, I'll tell you today, that lady's my wife.
Yeah.
So
I'm only in the midst of it, but I can't wait to see you guys out and finish it, because it's such a good story. You have four boys?
That's correct.
Yeah, what do they know about your life, your story, say?
My boys know, these are conversations I have with my boys all the time, you know. It's part of the work that I do within Yo' Bro, Yo' Girl Youth Initiative, right? The story resonates with kids within our programs and also my own children, right? They knew that Daddy at one time was a person that was in a lifestyle and was not doing well and was sick. And, you know, was a drug addict. And I have those conversations with my kids, right? You need to be able to have those conversations, or else then the kids are dealing with trauma. And if they're not able to deal with the trauma, then eventually down the road at some point, you know, who knows? That's the unpredictables, the unforeseeables. But at the end of the day, you know, it's conversations you need to have with your kids, right? Yeah. So they understand what I was going through, and regretfully, I know that I hurt them.
And I guess the powerful lesson in this is that anybody can fix their life. I mean, when you're balls deep into an organization like the Hells Angels, mm-hmm. or you're under the influence of drugs, mm-hmm. When you are in the midst of that, I don't know if you can see the light at the end of the tunnel. But you eventually do, don't you? And you decide that, yeah.
Well, there's one of two roads. Either the light goes out,
yeah,
or the light turns on. And if the light goes out, you're dead and gone. So, you know, yes, there's hope for everybody. That's what the story is about, you know, redemption, recovery, hope. No matter what adversity you face, no matter what you're dealing with, you know, you come out the other side and then have the determination to set a goal and don't allow anything to stop you.
A remarkable part of Joe's story, in my mind, is how close he was to death. I mean, this wasn't a guy who was just kind of cruising along, a little drug issue.
Yeah, thing on the weekend.
Recreation, you know? Yeah, recreation. User. No, he was somebody who really was staring death in the face. When I first saw him after he had come out of the hospital, somebody had taken a baseball bat to his jaw. The jaw was broken. He had a patch, and I'm talking about a gauze patch in this case, mm-hmm. that was oozing liquid, and he was emaciated. And I took one look at him. I could hardly believe this was the same guy I had known. And people said he was better at that point than he had been prior to his being led in to see me at the school board office. I mean, it's kind of amazing to me in a short period of time, really, how far this guy has come.
Yeah, and I guess you do need to hit rock bottom. You need that kick in the ass to really, I mean, you have to decide that you want to fix your life. But I mean, you need some circumstances to get there. You know.
Yeah, you know, the unforeseeables, like when you hit that rock bottom, you know, what does it look like? How do you lift yourself up, and how do you move forward? You know. At the end of the day, for everybody, it's going to be something different, right? You know, each person deals with their own issues. And all I say is, at the end of the day, no matter what, set your goal, get yourself up and out, lift yourself up, dust yourself off. You know, people will give you a hand up and help, yeah. Right? But you got to want the help.
What do you tell young people that you talk to today as part of your girl? And the talking that you do in schools about drugs, because I mean a lot of young people want to experiment, or they think it's a recreation, or they think that it's something that they can do. What do you tell them about your own experience and what they probably don't know about, you know, drugs and the road that'll lead to?
Well, for me, it's real simple. You know, we have a statement within the organization. Gary's also on the board.
Right.
And it's a real simple statement. You know, we can show them all the video you want. We can do all the one-off presentations you want. We can show you what that looks like. And at the end of the day, the slogan for us is, you don't have to stop what you haven't started.
Mm.
Right? So at the end of the day, that's part of our theme, you know. And then it's consistent dialogue. And that dialogue is not us always speaking. It's we like to listen to our kids within the organization. They educate us. We don't live in their space in 2017. It is a lot different than when you were back in school in 96, 95, you know, 94. It's a different bird now, you know. Yeah. We have a drug on these streets called fentanyl, carfentanil, acrofentanil. It's an elephant tranquilizer. How did we get here?
Yeah.
One of the other things that I just want to add, because I think it's an important part of the work Joe's doing, is that we know kids are going to experiment. I mean, we can say you don't have to stop what you don't start. And that's where Joe's mantra, if you want to call it that, our important message starts. But we also know kids are going to experiment. I mean, we've all been there. We've had kids of our own. But I think the important thing is that through the power of peer mentorship, students will support other students who want to make changes in their lives. Young people will support other young people. Joe gives a lot of direction and a sense of training, a sense of confidence to the peer mentors. But they get, and this is maybe a bad metaphor in the times of Donald Trump, but they get in the swamp with that student.
Mm.
And they work with that young person to help that person who wants to get away from the kind of drugs that he or she might be using to create a better life for himself or herself. That's part of the power, I think, of what's happening right now with the organization.
And when you look back at it all, Joe, do you think about what you could have needed back then that would have probably been better for you? I mean, is that what, if you had those mentors in your life, would it have been a different life for you?
It could have been a different life, but as crazy as it may seem, you know, at the end of the day here, the organization that we now have been able to create, and, you know, this book going out there as a tool in the toolbox, not only for, you know, the general public, but for educators. You know, Gary will talk about what he's developed around the book. You know, this tool that goes in the toolbox, we believe, will help parents, educators, policing detachment, social services, general public. And the best piece that I like is a parent will be able to pick up this book, drop it in front of their kid, and say, if you're going to make that choice, maybe you should read this story.
Yeah, it is such a, I mean, as I'm reading it, I'm thinking, how many people will be helped by this?
Well, you know, that's a great point, Joseph, because I've thought about that myself. And there's something that I hear all the time that kind of concerns me. And that something is, if we, and I don't care who is saying this, if we are able to save one life, then it's all worthwhile.
Yeah.
And I think that sets the bar so ridiculously low that we're not looking to help one person or one student. We're looking to help a number of young people. And I think that's what Joe has said as his mission in life as he moves forward. And certainly what we're supporting through the Yo Bro, Yo Girl Youth Initiative is Joe and his work, but also the young people who are a critical part of the organization. It's the young people who increasingly are driving this organization, because Joe by himself can't be everywhere at once.
Yeah.
And so when we talked about what do you do, Joe, in moving forward, how do you look at scaling this so that you can reach a vast number of young people, not just one or two or three or four, but a vast number? The model that we've adopted is this peer mentorship model, so the kids who go through the program, who benefit from the program, who believe that it's made a difference in their lives, turn around and share through training and experience that with other young people. I think it's a very powerful model.
People are looking for something in their life, and I guess they can find it in positive things, or they can find it in negative things. And I think that's the work that you both do now. I mean, you're giving a lot of people, young people especially, the opportunity to meet better people or to meet the good people that they need to meet, right?
Well, and that's just it. Like what Gary was talking about, our current model, you know, one of the things that we were challenged with in the very beginning stages of the organization is, okay, that's great. You got a real sexy story, Joe. But at the end of the day, say you get hit by a bus. So the good old bus, you know, hit by the bus analogy.
Yeah.
I didn't like that guy much, but he kept saying it over and over and over as he had more and more drinks. And I didn't appreciate getting hit with a bus, but today I appreciate it, because what we've been able to do is not duplicate Joe, but replicate a model. And at the end of the day, so our youth go through our program. They then have the opportunity to become a youth leader. And, you know, to be a youth leader, hey, it's real simple. Don't engage in, you know, illegal behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Go to school. Be a good person in the community. And we don't ask them all to be A-plus students. If you can, that's awesome. But if you can't, we just want you to pass your classes. And if you can't and you need support, then we'll get you the support that you need. Then there's a whole model around the youth leaders. They go through a whole gamut of training, first aid, mental health, first aid, national coaching certification, leadership training. So then we train them, okay? Then from there, they can become a program assistant. So they can start assisting a program facilitator. That's a step up from that. So once they graduate school, they get paid employment opportunities with the organization. Even our youth leaders get paid employment opportunities with the organization. Now, as we start to evolve, we're growing very organically with the mission, vision, purpose of the organization that they live, eat, and breathe every single day. They have an extended family from outside their own family, because a lot of these kids sometimes are coming from various different things at home, right?
Yeah.
So they have that sense of belonging within the organization, and all the way up to becoming program facilitators.
And so I hate to ask this question, but I mean, it is personally rewarding, this job that you have now, isn't it?
Very rewarding. Why would you hate to ask that?
Well, because people will think I'm asking about what it means to you. I mean, you are gaining back from what
I took away from people.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean, it must be gratifying to be able not only to say write your life, but to be able to help people that could go down the road that you went down.
Well, I think, you know, everybody wants to point the finger and say, well, it's you, Joe. Well, it's you, Joe. No, it's not. There's supportive directors involved. You know, there's Gary writing the book. There's my wife that does all the back end on the organization. Mm-hmm. You know, there's policing detachments. You know, we're part of Surrey's public safety strategy. You know, Surrey School District has been so spectacular to us. Like, they've embraced us. They've adopted us. They've, you know, made us a staple within Surrey School District. We have principals, administrators, teachers, counselors, you know, this whole system believing in what we do. So this ain't Joe, because if I didn't have you know, all these proper pieces of the puzzle, per se, then there would be no Joe. It's just, again, I'll go back to the stars are perfectly aligned. This is a huge team around what we're doing, an amazing team. So
you mentioned your involvement in Surrey. The problems in Surrey and the problems in this metropolitan area, are they solvable at all?
Well, everybody likes to bring this back to Surrey, but if we, Surrey's a hotbed, but let's not lose sight and sound of what goes on in Vancouver's Lower East Side, right? Take a look at the last week of shootings. They've been in Richmond, you know, Langley, Abbotsford, Vancouver. So this is not only a Surrey issue, but Surrey is, and I can tell you this for fact, the only district that has come out with a public safety strategy. They are the only district to have a game plan for the next 3 years. And Yobro, Yogirl, is part of that public safety strategy. So I do believe it's fixable. I do believe City Council is making unbelievable steps in the right direction. And Gary, maybe you want to jump in.
It's a great question. Is it solvable? And, you know, I think that it's like asking, can we wrestle the whole fentanyl crisis to the ground? Can we eliminate it? And I think all of us, you included, would say we sure want to do that.
Yeah.
And we will not stop trying to do that. I think if the effectiveness of programs like Yo Bro, Yo Girl, other initiatives that target young people, that give young people options, that dispel some of the myths that exist when it comes to the glamorization of drug use, gang involvement, you name it. I think if we can actually achieve that in large numbers, we will certainly, if not eliminate some of those issues, the terminology I used before, wrestle those issues to the ground. And for any family that's gone through any of these things, be it drug addiction or gang involvement, if they know there's resources to help them, help their family, help their young people, I think we're moving in the right direction. So I really I applaud the work, not that's just going on with Joe and Yo Bro, Yo Girl, but that's going on more broadly in looking at effective ways to address this. And, I mean, Joe's hitting on two key pieces here, not just one. Drug addiction, gang involvement. And that I think that when I listen to Dr. Perry Kendall and some of these people who are saying, we've got a crisis on our hands here in the province and nationally when it comes to drug use, opioid use, that Joe's not just reaching out, and it's not just a story about gang involvement. It's also a story about how we create positive addiction, if we want to call it that. People who are involved in positive things rather than negative things, and that's the reach of the organization. I pray and I hope that large numbers of kids can be empowered to do good, and that was the word you used earlier, good, or I guess you used it, Joe, to do good in our society.
Do you think that people in government or in education sort of dropped the ball that got to this point in recent years? Because we were talking, you were at Tupper when I was at Tupper, and this is the mid-90s. It was a pretty safe school when I was there, when
sure
you were
was.
There.
Yeah.
Before that, it was pretty violent.
It had the reputation of violence. I think, you know, I said that as a principal of Tupper, and I stand by the statement years later, and that was, the schools, and I use bad in quotation marks, the schools that were bad were never as bad as the reputations, and the good schools, again in quotation marks, were never as good.
Mm-hmm.
Tupper was never the violent, bad school that it was being portrayed as being in the media at the time. But there were incidents that had to be eliminated. There were kinds of subcultures that had to be eliminated. And that was the commitment we as a staff and the school community, parents and kids, made in the early 1990s. And you were part of the beneficiary, I think, Joseph. It was a darn good school when you went through. It remains that to this day.
Mm-hmm. Joe, when you look back at it, I mean, you have your life now in the between the covers of this book. What do you know now that you wish you knew earlier?
Well, I think, you know, today there's a lot more education and resources and, you know, understanding addiction. You know, addiction was very painful. I feel for all those that struggle with addiction. You know, at the end of the day, it's, you know, something that consumes your very essence. right? So the one takeaway for me would be, if I had more knowledge of where that journey was going to lead with drugs, I probably would not have went down that path, you know, quite as freely as I did. Yeah. So I think that's the critical piece, because, you know, what comes first, the chicken or the egg, or drugs and gangs, right? Yeah. So,
and I guess we're better now as a society in talking about addiction even, right? That when you were growing up, people didn't really talk about that sort of stuff, did they?
It wasn't something that was addressed in my household. And Joseph, was it addressed in your household?
Probably. No, it wasn't. No. Yeah. It's not something that I guess we encountered as often. Or if people did encounter it, they kept it behind closed doors and didn't talk about it. I mean, did you have that experience? What was going on at home never came out at school?
No, and certainly... in my growing up, which predates both of yours by a number of years, we just evolved from the stagecoach here, so yeah, maybe it was a different time. But no, my parents, the parents I knew of other kids where I grew up, which was a smaller city in British Columbia, did not talk to their kids about drug use. In fact, drug use was something that was happening, and it was happening pretty freely, but we would call them very soft drugs compared to today. But I knew kids in high school who, you know, were mainlining heroin at the time and things like that. Very, very few numbers, mind you. Very small numbers. I will guarantee the parents were not having conversations over the dinner table about that kind of drug use. So, yeah, there is. It is part of our national consciousness now. If nothing else, the fentanyl crisis has brought that conversation to the forefront. And we do talk much more openly about that.
Yeah, I mean, if someone drank too much, or you know, they couldn't handle their liquor, as opposed to, well, no, you do drink too much, right?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I understand that Joe, you're about to head off on a number of cities to talk about this book. Are you going along, Gary? Or?
The only city I'll be joining Joe in, it's because I've got work commitments at the University of British Columbia, but the only city that I will be joining Joe in is Winnipeg.
Right.
And we're going across Canada. We start in Toronto and then work our way through, I believe, 7 or 8 cities, you know, starting from Toronto, working our way back and doing various different things in, you know, Toronto, Saskatoon, Winnipeg, Calgary, Alberta, and so on.
You'll be talking to kids as well as adults, right?
Yes.
Yeah. That's very important, isn't it? Not just to talk to kids in schools. I mean, it is important to talk to kids in schools especially, but it's important to talk to these adults, especially, you know, when they have such a stake in all of this that they probably don't realize.
Well, absolutely, right? It has to be a conversation that everybody's having. Everybody has to be at the table today. And, you know, if there's a missing piece in that, then, you know, it makes it a lot more difficult for the youngster, the adult, whomever is struggling with whatever, to come out the other side. So,
Joseph. No, I was just going to say, one of the things we believe in the book is about the book is that it will be a conversation starter between adults and youth, between parents and their own kids. And so, in writing the book, I wanted to try to reach, and it's a tricky kind of challenge to reach both audiences, the adult audience who read it because it's a compelling story.
Mm-hmm.
But also it could be a gate opening to have that conversation with their children.
Yeah.
And then young people who can read it and say, wow, you know, I've got to think about my own life in terms of the decisions I make at this age and stage. So that's the kind of general direction we tried to give the book. And as I say, it is a bit of a challenge writing that so that you're reaching both audiences. The story has to compel. Technically, the writing has to be at a level that young people can read it with ease of understanding.
They can read the parts in italics. It's Joe's voice, right. Right?
That's right. Exactly.
And it's a clever way to tell the story, because you want to hear from Joe. You want to hear what the experiences are. I mean, it's one thing to write about what happened to him,
right,
but to hear his voice and to hear what's going through his mind as all of this happens, and then to see the perspective later on of what he thinks happened. I mean, it's fascinating to you know, it's such a compelling read, and you know, I think you're both to be congratulated for this book.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. I appreciate you coming in to do this. I wanted to ask you, Joe, what was your first cell phone?
My first cell phone, yeah. Motorola 8000.
And what year was that? Would it have been the early 90s?
89, 90, yeah. When I was with A&B Sound. So, and the first cell phone that I started selling was the Motorola 8000.
Yeah,
and then I went to the Talkman.
And then you went in, you got into that business when just cell phones were just starting.
Yeah.
That was the early 90s.
$1,800 for a phone that resembled the brick.
Yeah. And yeah. And
we called it the club.
Yeah. And so what do you use now? I was trying to catch a glimpse there. On the.
I'm a Galaxy guy. I'm Samsung. I've been in the retail industry a majority of my life, so I'm a big Matsushita Electronics guy.
Yeah.
So anything that is like Panasonic, Samsung, all of those kind of products. That's what's in my home. That's my phone. That's yeah. the product I believe in. So,
yeah. He's a great salesman, isn't he?
Well, I'm just sitting here listening to you two thinking this is not a conversation I joined because I have no idea one brand from another. I got my phone. It works. That's enough for me.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you coming in to do this. It's a pleasure to meet you, Joe, and I was just thinking, Gary, I don't think we really met at Tupper because I was never bad enough to...
That's probably a good thing, Joseph, if you're not known by the principal or always in the principal's office. This Joe, on the other hand, spent a lot of time in my office.
Before you leave, what's it like to work with him now, to work with Gary?
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah. So, you know, how do you ever have an opportunity to have, you know, your kind of high school counselor, the only guy I looked up to in the school, with the exception of Jimmy, you know, but we all had a little bit of fear of this guy, and he'll always shake his head and go, no. You just have to worry when Gary Little looked like he had his skates back on and he was skating down the hall, and then poof, all of us were gone. But now to come back and have him not only as the writer, a mentor, a friend, you know, part of our organization, it's amazing.
You know? What do you learn from him, working with him now after all these years?
The most important thing I've learned through this whole process is that it's one thing to talk about resilience, it's one thing to talk about redemption, but when you see it lived, when you see a person push through barriers that for most of us would finish us, it's inspirational. And I always remember hearing the Dalai Lama speak to a group of young people in Vancouver at a Meet a We Day, and he talked about the importance of hope. And I just, if nothing else comes out of this book, I want it to inspire young people to have hope and to know that there's always an opportunity to do the best they can with their own lives.
Gentlemen, I appreciate you coming to do this, and continued good luck with the book.
Thanks, Joseph.
The book is called To Hell and Back, a former Hell's Angels story of recovery and redemption. Its authors Joe Calandino and Gary Little join me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planto.